the atmosphere in the air that comes from this beautiful covered farm cookies? At what cost are cookies?
Not at all.
Our panel has been hard at work doing an uncontrolled experiment of sorts. Cookies, I have to Bob Barker is coming later today, 6:30. When is this possible to come to? And then Andy Rooney is coming as well. I've been friends with Elijah Soon twice in my life, at least in writing. Doesn't count the time, but it's a worldly friend. And Andy Rooney was one. So I'm happy to ask about that. Not only that, but it's like another one. Today we have a fascinating class extending quite nicely our tour of corporate surveillance. And trying to come up with why would a company want to do this. Mostly came up with, aside from several sci-fi scenarios, had to do with dog food ads. There may be other reasons apart from the sale of dog food, and we're going to investigate some of them today. And we're going to do it not only with the help of our panel, which is currently munching, but also with Professor Levine, who has agreed to join us and is actually working on price discrimination from an academic standpoint now, not formally. He did it from kind of a practical standpoint. He was the one that sold you airline tickets at different rates depending on Facebook and such. But now he's studying from an academic standpoint that's going to help us through some of the prospects and implications of price discrimination on the internet. And we've just had up on the screen for a while some of Professor Levine's amazing background. This is somebody who is clearly quite expert in the field. And we're very lucky to have him with us today. So, welcome. I don't know if you've used this room before. You didn't have to
come out. Honestly, it's high tech. I usually love the mechanical systems of my voice. Can you hear me in the back?
They can't.
They're not willing to commit themselves.
Uh-huh.
Well, should I use the mic or not?
Yes.
Okay.
No, it's not a protocol.
All right.
Maybe the useful place to start would just be start from part of your many core expertises, but one core expertise which has to do with airlines. And maybe we can just talk a little bit about how airlines do what they do and get to the bottom of ticket pricing, how that works.
Okay, let's start with the fundamental problem if you are an airline is this. You know what it costs to run your system for a day, all these flights that come together at hubs. You have hubs because you want to be able to provide frequent transportation between a lot of cities that couldn't support full planes on their own to go back and forth frequently. For example, you're in Des Moines, Iowa. In Des Moines, Iowa, there may be enough business to support 20 flights a day, but no more than one or two flights a day to all to the biggest cities, and fewer than that. Customers would rather have the opportunity of tailoring their trip to their business needs and so on. So you decide to fly people from Des Moines to Chicago or Minneapolis or St. Louis and give them a chance to connect on a good day, at least to connect to perhaps 60 or 70 destinations, allowing you to have very frequent service. So that turns what you're doing from, how to put it, a service provided on a one-by-one basis to a network that is effectively create a virtual network every day when you operate the airlines. And networks have the following characteristics. One, it's very difficult to know the cost of serving a particular customer. Leaving aside the meal that one of you might eat and the very few extra pounds of fuel that adding a person to an airplane costs, basically, if the plane is flying from Des Moines to Chicago, I know that cost. And if I have planes flying from Chicago to all these other places, all the places they go to, I know that cost. But I don't know the cost of carrying a passenger from Des Moines to Philadelphia or New York or Buffalo or any other place.
You might know the average cost, right?
Yeah, so
you divide by the number of seats.
Well, I have to do that, but then I wouldn't get to make very many flights. I'll give you a quick thought experiment. Imagine a two-seat airplane, and you have two customers. One of whom is willing to pay $100 to go from A to B, another one of whom is willing to pay $50 to go from A to B. The cost of the trip is $140 to fly the airplane, $140. I have a problem. If I charge the average cost, which is $75, the flight will never go. One person will happily buy a ticket, but the other one will be priced away and won't go. Yet the flight could, in fact, make money, which means that the resources that are needed to make the flight work are valued enough by the customers to make it worth providing that transportation. The only way to provide that transportation, that two-seat example, is to charge them two different prices. And in fact, oddly enough, they're both better off. And you can't easily say that one is subsidizing the other. In fact, if it weren't for the $50 person, the flight wouldn't go. And if it weren't for the $100 person, the flight wouldn't go. You have to, if it costs you $140, you have to get $140 in revenue to make this flight go. The network is that problem to the nth power. Okay? So I naturally have to sit down and start figuring out what I'm going to charge people. If I charge people average cost, I'll have many, many fewer flights than if I try to differentiate people by how much they value the flights. Now, standard, the paper I'm working on right now, standard textbook economics, including the textbooks you have given us, say that you have to have a monopoly to do the kind of price discrimination I just described. The assumption being that otherwise the woman you're trying to charge $100 to would go somewhere else to get her ticket instead of paying you the $100. The assumption being somehow someone else would charge her the $75. But of course, if they charge the $75, the flight won't go.
Including the competitors. So
everyone is facing an equilibrium in which to recover the cost of the network, they have to price discriminate. This is what the literature does not understand very well. Those of you who are actually interested in this problem, shameless advertising, we'll try to double my number of readers from 12 to 24. On the Harvard website, on the Olin Center website is paper number 276, which is called Price Discrimination Without Market Power.
And it's free to anybody who wants to get it.
Read to anyone who wants to read it.
Media is not your
message. That's exactly right. But that's because Harvard extracts in a price discriminatory way from its alumni the money to support the website. And from its students, I should say, that's where a scholarship is a form of price discrimination.
And that's a more textbook form.
Right, that's right. But anyway, let's return to this. The point is, I have to, even as a competitor, start figuring out what people will be willing to pay me, and my competitors will have to do the same thing. So we will start segmenting our markets according to our assumptions about the demand curves of business travelers, leisure travelers, travelers who are willing to travel on one-stop flights as opposed to non-stop flights. Remember, it costs no more to carry you on a one-stop flight than a non-stop flight, given that the flights are going to go through the hub. But we charge you more. In fact, in principle, it charges because you no more carry you on any flight in the hub system than on any other flight until you bump another passenger, at which point I have an opportunity cost. Okay? So I adopt a price discriminatory strategy. Now that doesn't mean I don't have a monopoly on some of that traffic. Some of the traffic I might have a monopoly on, but I like a conventional argument. You can't tell whether I have a monopoly by looking at whether I'm price discriminating. Usually the textbook would say you can infer market power from the fact that I can price discriminate. I argue that you can't. Restaurants charge more, have a higher profit market margin on drinks than they do on food. They charge, they have a higher profit margin on dinner than they do on lunch, unless they're in a downtown business area in which they have a higher profit margin on lunch. And we'll have specials for dinner, and it's all part of the same thing, which is recovering fixed costs by spreading them across customers according to how much they value. Amazon, which is one of the examples you're using here, is a perfect example of that. It costs whatever it costs to put up the website and hold the inventory. Okay. I am now desperately interested in finding out, especially since we know Amazon at the moment is not reaping any profits. Not reaping any profits at all. It's not surprising that they would begin to experiment with price segmentation. Now, maybe they can really stick some customers because they are the only place on the web you can get a particular book. Maybe other customers are buying very competitive books. It may be that some customers demonstrate by some characteristic, which you might get from double click or some other way, by some other known characteristic that they're likely to. Less likely to click off and go to vn.com and find out what the same book costs. I am a compulsive shopper. I rarely buy a book online without having these two windows open. Many people won't bother with that. It's time, probably. You can probably show me that the amount of time it takes me costs me more than what I claim to value my time at. But apparently, I either get recreational value from shopping, or I have the voice of my father in my ears telling me not to pay too much.
He's got a nice time with that.
Well, that's right. Well, I can use some of the figures for the shopping costs.
So I want to continue. So I saw Darren, you had a question, and it's the remote comment kind of thing today, or not? Darren, it could be. All right, well, we'll figure that out. Darren, what's on your mind?
That's a little bank. I was wondering what the URL was for that paper.
I'm not that good.
That's not like it. law@harvardedu.com/Olin_center, and then follow the prompts.
Discussion papers, yeah.
Your eyes may have to raise other
papers. Then you go to 2000, and it's 276.
Great. Other questions so far on Kansas? So one question you have is how much your airline example, which by your thought experiment does seem to be, no matter how much competition you have, it may well be that price correction will happen. You can even shop on it.
Even Southwest Airlines, which does business doing less price discrimination than some competitors and charges often lower prices, has promotional fares, is subject to the same sort of logic. They have promotional fares, they do all sorts of things to try to segment their customers in order to be able to offer a competitive level of frequency of service to the customers. If Amazon didn't price discriminate, for example, why do you sell bestsellers for much closer margins than you do obscure books? Even if you don't have a monopoly, that is, even if BN.com and Amazon both have the book, if you go to find some obscure title, you will find it with a larger markup on it than a bestseller. The reason is that people who buy bestsellers in general are very aware of what their alternatives are and will click off much, much quicker if they don't see a price that attracts them. In the same way, supermarkets take much lower markups on meat than they do on cereal. Every supermarket does. All supermarkets that stay in business do, let me put it that way. And it's the same principle. People are attracted to the store because for most consumers, meat is their...
Come for the meat, stay for the grain.
That's more or less, that's right. Come for the meat, pick, grab a bottle of corn, the package of cornflakes on your way out of the store, and you won't change supermarkets over the price of cornflakes, but you will change supermarkets over the price of meat.
And of course, always put the milk in the very, very pack.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay, so we have a story of price discrimination that may, from the textbook, come as a monopoly thing. May, if not the textbook, come as a result of...
As a way to recover your overhead costs.
Which is a clear way to know
right, that's right.
Amongst the different people. Now, maybe it's worth jumping to the website Priceline.com, since you're sticking with airline examples. I don't know how familiar you are with Priceline. So before we get your view on it, let's put it to some of our... general public here. Here's Priceline.com. Has anybody here used Priceline? Wow! I am shocked and amazed. So, how many people have actually bought tickets to Priceline? Okay. A few still have. So, why don't you tell us about your experience, if you don't mind? How did it work?
I just went to the site and put in, I actually went twice, went in once and put in a bit of Paris. I put in a certain amount, and then they rejected my offer, and then I put it in again, and they took out.
So how does it work? How does it work? You go to the site. I don't know if you want to keep the site on there. You go to the site, and then
you have, I'm trying to remember, I think you just put in sort of your travel plan. You don't need to put in what time during the day. They can give you if you're flexible. And they give you sort of discover for about $30 to your offer. They give you there's certain promotions that I'll make your offer. And then they give you
your address and they respond to you. But do they tell you how much it will
cost? No.
What happens instead?
You put in how much you want to pay. Yeah.
Mainly, if we're looking at our textbook, your reservation price.
Yes.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
That's your reservation.
Except it actually doesn't end up being your reservation. Well, it has to go higher because they don't tell you. somebody goes through taxes or anything else, they end up adding $8 if you've added to the price.
And your flu carrots, and you're inside the plane, families are all sitting.
Yes. And you can just track $8 or whatever from your reservation.
So would you use it again?
I think I would. If I was in the same position, I would be buying kids' carrots.
So are there other people who have similar or different experiences? Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, there was in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, they reported that there's a website where users of Priceline compare the prices that have been accepted. So,
sure, what's the website address? Let's throw that up on my ass. Yeah, maybe William Shatner will appear. My lord, it's a complicated address. But we'll pass that to John. Carson, other experiences with Priceline? Is there pretty much an app to what you mean?
Malda.
Do they map Malda's experiences? No, what was your experience?
I didn't raise my hand because I've never actually purchased from them, but I have gone through 45 minutes each time compared to where I'm playing out the prices, basically what I can find. And they constantly make you, if you want to up the bid, change some other flexibility. So you need to start very narrow. This is advice you want to use. Start very narrow at first. Because that's sort of your bargaining chips to change your bid. So the first time comes, you can only go on those days and you only take a left seat or whatever. And then
you're playing poker with prices.
You are. I mean, you really are. Because, like, there were some of those things I didn't do the same thing. I don't care about that. And so I gave them away right up front. And I'd give them the cow away or whatever. Because they were going to, later on, I could use that. And I didn't care. And I took.
And do you think you were negotiating with a person on the other day, smoking cigars, high hours, or is
it? My expectation is there's just a machine that was just going boom, and this whole thing's an artifice, and they could have given it back to you in 10 seconds. They could have just told you. Because I figured there's some computer somewhere that's telling them this is the price we'll accept on a given day at a given time, and boom, and they just throw away half an hour for nothing.
That's very insightful. The whole premise of Priceline is to reduce the value of the transaction to you so that the airline doesn't believe it would have sold the ticket to you anyway. Otherwise, why would the airline let Priceline sell you a seat for a price lower than the airline could sell it to you and have, after all, the airline has to pay Priceline? So the assumption is that if you don't know exactly when you're going to travel and you don't know exactly which airline you're on, and you're willing to go through all this rigmarole, you must be a person who's really price sensitive. And that there's no danger that we could have sold you the ticket cheap, except that what's going on now is the airlines naturally started to figure out how to cut the price line out of the process and either invent value diluting premises on their own or use ones that have already been in them. I mean, the reason for 21 days advance purchase is not that it costs the airline any less to carry it.
I do use smarterlooking.com, which is a much better way to look for last minute fares because they just list all a bunch of them. There's the price, they tend to be pretty cheap.
Well, the airlines now are beginning to work on a Priceline light device that won't require you to name your own price, but that will obscure certain details of your trip in an effort to say that if you want this price, you have to basically accept that obscuration and that's where you get the price, and then to basically reveal to you more information on ever pricier terms as you narrow it down to something you really want. The whole point is to separate people who value more getting the flight they want when they want it, because part of the value created by the network is choice, from people who don't really need choice, so that you can paradoxically create as big a network as possible. You create a bigger network if you charge people who value choice more than you charge people who don't value choice. And all these are techniques for beginning to separate out markets, because we know, just because there are smart folks like you out there, that you can't live with having the person walk up to the counter and then you ask them, well, how much are you willing to pay? You know, you don't belong at the Harvard Law School if you name your maximum price. And the assumption is that people will behave strategically unless you find some method of separating, like forcing people to stay over Saturday night days in advance, or to go on a website and go through this fucking process.
But now the method by which Priceline seems different from any other discount site, for which it has sought a patent, which has had different ups and downs, and what William Shatner bellows about on the ads, is that you can name your price, and then that's freedom for you, because you'll never end up paying more than you want to, because you just named your price.
Have you ever paid any more than that? Assuming we all want everything for nothing. But beyond that, when a transaction takes place, it always takes place at a price you find acceptable.
So you're saying this is a given?
You could say that.
I'm shocked. Beyond Gimmick, though, I mean, Gimmick might say is equivalent, essentially, to any other form of shopping. Is it actually eliciting, perhaps, for many customers, true reservation prices?
Depends on how strategic the customer is and how many times she's used the site. You notice that you put your bid in, multiple your bid in the second time. I would bet that at that price level, the computer was programmed to reject your first offer, but to accept it only if it was your second offer. Was it in the same session?
Yeah.
Was it in the same session? Well, then it's possible supply and demand have changed. It's also possible that the program actually counts the number of bids made at a certain price, and only accepts a bid if it turns out there's substantial demand at that price, but not at higher prices.
Yeah,
Both of my Priceline experiences were tickets that I wouldn't have purchased if I had not gotten them at the price. The only Priceline, as far as I can tell after the search, the only Priceline offer.
Well, you are the perfect customer from your standpoint and the airline standpoint. That's if there wasn't some hope of reaching from the airline standpoint of reaching those customers, Priceline would be much less valuable because you can always offer things at various prices. And it's the combination of attracting you and also selling a certain number of tickets to people who naively reveal prices that are higher than you're willing to sell tickets at. That is the appeal of Priceline.
So he's basically the coupon flipper. He's somebody who is going to look for the discount and just won't buy the meat or the cereal unless it's really, bedrock price. And this is a means to even further refine.
Maybe someone who just doesn't have the means or doesn't value the trip enough. That is, it's a weekend trip. And what the heck, I'd do it for $99 or I wouldn't do it for $200.
Yeah.
And our most, for everybody who I've spoken to use Priceline, I don't know if maybe there are this big contingency of night shoppers, but I think most people who use Priceline sort of shop around like, might as well, we're here for this cheap price, I might as well go.
That's why Priceline stock doesn't sell for as much as it used to while people more naive about how it might work. I agree with what you're saying. I don't think it's a great business proposition. When it was first explained to me, I was running the commercial side of Northwest Airlines, and it didn't sound like such a great idea to me. We then concluded that obscuring the details of the trip was a potentially valuable price discriminator. But we were asked to invest in it. And in fact, Northwest took its time investing in it. Delta Airlines, which I rarely think of as being smarter than we were at Northwest, in this particular case convinced themselves that it was worth investing in and then intelligently enough sold out at the top and did not buy the stock back down. So they had the best, they had a better picture of what would sell of the initial blush of value that might be created than if we did. But I don't think long term is a very effective business model. And you notice that they attempted to spread it to other activities and it didn't work very well. I still think there is a necessity for price discrimination, and there is value as a price discriminator in making it hard to get exactly what you want unless you pay more. That has value, and I think that you don't need market power to do that. Now, the prices you can actually sell at may be affected by the amount of market power you have. That is mixed in with all that, and less in the Priceline situation than in the Amazon type situation. Maybe the possibility of exploiting market power more effectively than you could if you attempted to sell at single price.
Other questions on Priceline? Yeah, in the back, go ahead.
I think one of the problems with Priceline is that Well, there are two things. One is that I know people who have used Priceline, they were going to a wedding, wanted to stay in a hotel, you know, just went ahead with the Priceline thing, got what they thought was a great price, and then we're sitting at a rehearsal dinner, and somebody was like, you idiot, if you just call, the hotel will quote you a better price than that in the first place. So I think that without investing a lot of time in research, you end up having a real potential to overprice yourself on that. And then second of all, I've had a very, very bad Priceline experience, which ended up costing me four times as much as I would pay if I just paid the fare that I walked up to the counter. and I also ended up flying from New York to Orlando via Detroit and Texas.
That sounds like Northwest to me.
It was Northwest, actually. And I will never fly them again. But I think the thing is that...
We did that to you.
I know. The thing is that people may be dumb enough to underprice by $30 or whatever, and it's all great and fine if every connection goes like that. But once you've done it once and it's gone all wrong, and the airlines have had no sympathy to you because they know you paid such a low price for your ticket, I will never do that again, because I spent 2.5 days heading from Orlando, from New York to Orlando, so and it's not worth it's worth more than $30 to me.
Can we separate out two aspects of it, though? Finding out, like your friends at the wedding did, that you paid too much is a separate question from deciding that the product being offered, namely a multi-stop trip, isn't worth what it cost you. Those are two very different things. In the first place, it was worth what it cost your friend, but she or he had buyer's remorse because she found that she didn't have to pay that much. And that's something you can do, have happen to you, even if you buy quite conventionally. How many times have you bought something and then seen the sale for it in the paper a week later and discovered you could have saved money or gone into another situation in which you just hadn't shopped here, but already decided it wasn't worth shopping here. The other thing is to discover by experiment that some things aren't worth saving money. Certainly the older and richer I've got, the less I will put up with in order to save money. And that varies for individuals according to their age, position in life, value of leisure time, and willingness to go via Michigan and Texas to get the Florida.
So we have
I was confused about why you feel that obscuring choice is a better way of lowering prices. We're talking about obscuring choice in the sense that you know you're paying less, but you don't know whether it's the side of the United States or the 2 week advance. Why not just attach prices to all the conditions and then have full information to the consumer?
The idea was, the theory that we thought was attractive about Priceline was that we could do all of those things. Northwest could. But Northwest couldn't obscure that you were doing business with Northwest. It's true, we could have offered you a ticket with as many different impediments on it as we wanted. But we thought Priceline added yet another impediment. You didn't know which airline you were flying. That, I think, has proved to be probably less valuable than we thought. And one of the many reasons why Priceline isn't as effective a business as some people thought it might be is it turns out that you can offer people certainty about the airline they're flying, but you can offer all the other kinds of inconveniences and uncertainties as ways of expectation. There's nothing to keep Northwest or American or Delta or whoever from offering you a ticket on the following terms. We'll get you to your destination before midnight of the day you want to go. But we're not going to tell you what flight you're going to be on until a week before you fly. We could do that. We could offer that. And we might as well have to offer that at a very low price. And that's a business proposition that you could accept or reject. that mimics some aspects of Priceline. You can do it in a number of different ways. You're right. The value of obscuring the value of obscuring choice is it makes the trip less interesting. It will make many people, it will make only really price-conscious people interested in buying the ticket. And what you're trying to do is develop a set of prices such that the only people who buy tickets at the lowest prices are people who wouldn't have bought tickets at any other price.
Here it is, here is just from a fact written by a travel agent's turncoat, somebody who is sort of like a magician revealing his tricks, published a fact on how travel agents do what they do, and said, Priceline.com is a consolidator with a huge disadvantage that they don't reveal their prices. Don't get these Priceline with an auction. Priceline says themselves they're not an auction. They have a contract price with airlines just like any other consolidator. And it's such a pricing mechanism to name your own price. It ensures you pay as much as you were willing and no less. You offer 50 more than Priceline's contracted cost or $500 more. The airline gets the same amount, and Priceline pockets the difference.
That's not quite subtle enough, though. The price that the airline can sell to Priceline at includes Priceline's calculation that there will be some tickets on which they will make a good margin and others not. So
Priceline, in turn, is somehow pricing. Let's be clear then. When we're talking about what these airlines are doing, it is absolutely a price discrimination, right? There's no doubt about it.
Third degree price discrimination, as it's described in the
Yes, it sounds like it's kind of burns. But yes, it's third degree price discrimination. And I take it that Robinson patent in no way alarms you or worries you about what's going on.
Because if you get your mind's worth out of your legal education, you'll discover that Robinson patent applies only to commodities.
Not to services, but to those airline flights. So Robinson patent matters not one whit.
Right.
Now, could the Federal Trade Commission someday take it upon itself to decide this is an unfair and deceptive trade practice?
Well, yes, but the problem is that unfair or deceptive trade practices, which are not literally deceptive, typically have to have as their content some aspect of antitrust law. That is, FTC, this is a complication in the reading of the FTC Act,
right.
But the FTC's jurisdiction is unfair and deceptive practices. If a practice is actually deceptive, it has independent jurisdiction to determine that it's deceptive and that consumer is being defrauded. But to argue that something is unfair and deceptive as a term of art because it represents the unfair exercise of market power actually is limited by the standards the courts have used to interpret the Sherman and Clayton Act, of which the Robinson Patent Act is a section of the Clayton Act, so they actually don't have any jurisdiction.
And thus we see, relating back for a moment to some of our privacy stuff and the regulatory responses to fears about privacy abuses by some on the internet, that the FTC has stayed well within whatever court it may have jurisdiction by saying, we're going to make sure you have a privacy policy so that people are not deceived about what's going to happen to their personal information. But of course, we're not necessarily going to tell you what the policy should say. You just need to have one and then stick to it. And that seems consonant with this reading of the jurisdiction of the FTC to stick with what's deceptive rather than a substantive idea about what kinds of transactions ought to be allowed and what ought not to be allowed, absent some reading of, say, the antitrust law that is kind of a touchstone for substantive stuff. Okay, so let's start moving this then in the direction of the internet, because on the internet, as we found, there is some prospect for consumer empowerment in shopping. There's this sense of maybe friction-free markets because you don't have to wander from one store to the next to get a price quote on something. You can just ask my Simon to list them all for you, or just in the auction context until a lawsuit cases it out. Bidder's Edge will tell you what different auctions are selling the same item for. So you get some sense that you can have actually wonderful competition because at a single click, even the busy but rich can still save money and honor their parents because it only takes a click to figure out what the lowest price is. So that's the empowerment we see on the consumer side. We simultaneously see empowerment on the supplier side in that I gather the kinds of information we figure you could get on people, they don't even know their name. So you may have some sense of their prior habits and purchases and transactions. Certainly, if they were, if you were a merchant with you earlier, may empower you to get a sense for how big the wallet is, what the reservation price on a given item might be, whether for wallet size or for other reasons, and allow you to charge accordingly. So here we then have maybe an immovable object and an irresistible force. What's going to happen?
Well, when you're getting his information on the slopes of people's demand curves, you will be limited by competition among vendors or people with that characteristic. To the extent that people can vendors can identify people whose demand curves are more certain slope, they will all try to charge them more than they charge people with demand curves who are which are flatter. But in the end, their total revenue will be constrained by competition, except where they have monopoly, in which case that information becomes particularly valuable because
now they don't get
profit. Now it tells you how much you know.
And the first part of what you just said is sort of your theory that's
right.
A little bit counterintuitive for economists.
But correct, of course.
And the second is textbook behavior. What you're saying basically is no matter what car dealer I go to, if I look like a schmuck, I'm going to get treated like a schmuck, even as I try to go to another. Yeah, Eric.
The thing that so creeps me out about the readings that we did for today, and what seems to be the difference to me between price discrimination at the airline and on Priceline and all the ways that discussed to this point is that in those cases, individual consumers put themselves into a price category. In other words, there's a system that allows for price discrimination to happen that might be the most economic beneficial way for the market for all consumers, but consumers themselves decide, I'm in this category.
I'm going to present my ARC card and then get a discount.
And the consumer might put themselves in different categories in a way that a supplier might not expect based on the cookies that follow me around when I surf web. But with the internet information gathering, it allows other people to decide where I fit into their idea. And I don't really, it may be right or may be wrong, but I lose all control over that.
It happens to you all the time. First of all, I find some of this pretty creepy too, so that's not to deny what you're saying. But when you go to buy a car, you present yourself by your style, by what you indicate that you're. For example, they ask you what color. Have you ever noticed people like to ask you what color you really like when you buy a car? One of the reasons they would ask is tend to ask you that early in the transaction is they're trying to find out if you're a buyer who's going to become attached to the car, in which case they can charge you more. And if you're a buyer who doesn't give a damn whether she buys a Honda or a Toyota and she doesn't care if it's in black, silver, or yellow. In fact, one method car companies have used price discrimination in the past, they don't seem to do it as much anymore, is to produce limited editions of cars with really awful colors to be sold to customers who really are very price sensitive and are just looking for transportation.
That's why my car has gold up against. I thought it was in the depth deterrence feature.
There's a story in this article that's on the web that at one point the Chrysler Corporation didn't have enough money to match a new wave of compact cars that were coming on the market. So they decided to take their regular cars, which they put them for, use the incremental cost of production on, and paint them in really, truly dreadful colors for limited editions, and try to sell them to people who were in the market for cheap transportation and who perhaps preferred a large car in an ugly color to a small car in an attractive
color. You just have to love capitalism. It's extraordinary.
But my point is, what people do, anytime you're not in a fixed price conference, there are obviously, if you walk into a store and there's a little price label, you know the prices are non-negotiable. There's not there to be price discrimination going on. Okay? So there may be between in stores with, for example, outlets. Outlet branches located inconveniently to get that.
I need a store. I just need to have it far away from any population.
And that helps a lot.
And that's where our
whole reason that outlet malls are sort of over as a really good distribution system as they hope to many of them and they became more convenient. While they were really inconvenient, you could afford to have really good merchandise sitting out there in Manchester, Vermont, or wherever. Once they became very convenient, it was no longer an effective method of price discrimination and you began producing seconds deliberately, or producing things marked as seconds deliberately, in an effort to price it.
Let's put a few deaths in our car.
But to go back to Aaron's point, in a non-strict fixed price environment, you are playing a game with the salesman who is playing a game with you.
But in those cases, there seems to be what the, I guess all the solution is always go somewhere else, take your business somewhere else. But in the
internet, whether these companies
are selling my information to all of the suppliers, that seems to be the difference. That
well, it is ugly to show up as Ryan, big spender, wherever you go. That's not a
way. Or is Aaron Ryan bad customer? Don't even deal with it.
Right.
And there could be a secondary market in other people's cookies who are really frugal, and then you can borrow the cookies for that month's worth.
Enough for some of this material is that there are secondary markets for bad customers who do pay more, but who get service they couldn't get. There are high-risk insurance companies, or companies that literally specialize in insuring high-risk drivers, and finance companies that specialize in bad credit. Now, again, as Elizabeth Warren would tell you, there are two phenomena going on at once in that. There is a legitimate market in high-risk customers. Some of those high-risk customers aren't maybe the brightest bulb in the collection, and they can be exploited into a degree beyond the risk they present by sort of location monopoly. If you just get them on the phone, you'll be able to sell them something eventually at a margin that exceeds the margin that their additional risk presents. So you have two things going on at once, just as I was describing in the Amazon
situation. Yeah, question back there.
In one of the readings, they had the example of Victoria's Secret, and they were talking about using different numbers, data lines, like some from e-commerce and some from older forms of data amassing from like consumer purchases and retail stores. So I wanted to know what change we're talking when we talk about new technology for data mining and e-commerce. I want to know how far back this sort of amassing personal data has gone, and before certain technological changes, how much data was amassed? You know, if you're a retail outlet, you couldn't, I assume, get the same amount of data you get in one click from a purchase on the web. So could you talk about that a little bit? How long has it
been? Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on retail. I mean, mostly have sold airline tickets, and I'm not an expert on selling other retail things. First of all, big companies, big stores, have tended to keep data on customers. Department stores and things like that. It gave an advantage actually being a big firm, is that you had more instances and more data and you could use it.
That might be incentive to offer the Macy's credit card, not because it's an ancillary credit business, but also because it's getting the data.
Well, this little tag, this Star Market tag, is all about trying to find out enough about me so they can figure out what promotions to offer. Now, so far they're not offering it to me. Well, I don't know the stuff they tell me, so maybe they are offering it to me. But this is also about that. There is a reason why stores really want you on their credit card. It's because they can amass information about it. Secondly, credit bureaus that serve this function for not so much about your case, because I don't think they were very good at mining that data, but certainly to the degree that you represented a credit risk, a small store in Peoria could get information on your activities for the last 300 years under your social security number and get access to the distilled value of that. And in fact, that was one of the first areas where people became very concerned about privacy.
Yeah. And just to say, thinking of Victoria's Secret, here is Victoria's Secret. They not that long ago, sent out catalogs, and it turned out some people got together and I guess were finding and compared Victoria's Secret's catalogs. And what they found was, depending on zip code, the identical catalogs format had different. Oh, Amanda, you have something on this. Why don't we not preempt your observation?
They compared and found out that they were getting the same prices, but they were getting different offers of coupons, kind of thing. So essentially different prices. And so someone decided to sue over that. And she failed. The court decided that her claims, which she based on RICO mostly. Yeah.
The racketeer.
Right.
Yeah.
That there was a pattern of sort of fraud against the customers. I think she was trying to work as a class action even. They said that this was a totally without basis and they did not have, there wasn't an underlying fraud, so there was no way there could be a pattern of fraud. And the claim was so frivolous that they actually Rule 11 sanctions against the attorney.
Now that's a rarity, isn't it?
Yeah.
The RICO claim, a RICO claim on something like that is beyond bizarre. But the more interesting question you might ask is why they didn't attempt some sort of process to happen.
Yeah, that was one of our questions.
The courts have been very hostile to the Robinson. The Robinson Patent Act was invented to protect neighborhood grocers against supermarkets, and that fight was over. And
it's not so much, when they talk about consumers in our readings on Robinson Patent, they're not so much talking about us. They're talking about consumers of pig iron who then use it to make ball bearings to send it on to somebody else, and volume discounts of pig iron that could disadvantage a smaller supplier of ball bearings in that supplier.
But also, small grocery stores which could buy at the same price as the supermarkets and therefore lost their customers at supermarkets. And then one of the most famous antitrust cases is the AMP case, in which this is back in the late 30s, as this revolution of retail was taking place, there was a notion that these supermarkets were all becoming monopolists and that they were driving these small stores out of business. So there was a time when there was a lot of enforcement of this kind of thing, and now the climate is so hostile to it that there are virtually no success.
Yeah, we've got a follow-up question.
I echo the sentiment. I'm a little creeped out by this, but then I'm confused about exactly what I'm creeped out by. And that's what I'm wondering is if companies have been doing this for years, like the reading said before, there was the advent of certain technologies made that might be quicker or more efficient, right? Then there's another element which was really creepy out was this idea of making consumers not making products, right? Like that was this concept. So I'm thinking, what am I creeped out by? Am I creeped out by evolutions in management theory, or am I creeped out by some technological shift that enable this, or what's the real change that's freaking me out now?
Well, this is much more in this area than mine, but I have a theory about this. And my theory is that most of us have been cut some slack in life, one way or another, by the fact that it's hard to collect complete information on anybody. And it's not easy, it's not hard to imagine back somewhere, and maybe your life is more acceptable to you than mine, but it's not hard to imagine some things I've done that it would embarrass me to have followed me all the way through my life. And the thought that someone can, at very low cost, assemble data on everything I've ever done, and in effect, cut me no slack. And that's a pun for those of you who follow principalation theory, meaning that is that people monitor me perfectly, is very disturbing to me. I would just assume, I'm not going to tell you what it is that I'm unknown. That would be a mistake, but I'm just assuming that most of us would not like to be tracked that closely. And by the way, I can tell you that when you're old enough to be a parent, you'll not want to track that close to what I had parent enough, I would say, a teenager or older child. You would not want to be able to track that child. So
there is a certain bliss. There's been an offender, but no story behind it. So let's give priority to our panel, and then we'll do a little product term study. It's a worthy idea to figure out. Start with the creeps and end with something more articulable as a tool. Yeah, go ahead, Sue.
Yeah, I think just following up on what people have been saying about the threat of a profile following you, because there's so much information that could be gathered from a bunch of different sites which are not on the internet. I think there's also the problem that the profile may be static. So right now, we don't necessarily have any way to access what's in that profile and to correct any information that might be wrong. And then we can't be sure whether, you know, say if our credit rating increases or if we become better consumers for a certain business, that our online profile that gets distributed to everybody is going to actually be updated as well. And I was just, when we were talking about it on the panel, I was sharing an experience that I had where, because I have a very, very common name, I was sent an email by allavantage.com, which said, you know, we know that you're engaged in a SIM plan and have been putting up all these different shell accounts to try to increase the points in your account. And I've never used allavantage.com. It was very alarming to me because I thought, well, you know, if that does become part of my online profile, then I don't want somebody thinking that I'm a SIM plan artist because I never did that.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's another problem too, is that we don't have access to the information that people are going to.
Yeah.
So sharing a soft story, I had a credit report issued on me about 5 or 6 years ago that said I hadn't paid a dental bill or something. It took me like over a year now to fix it. I couldn't get a credit card for over a year. Same with the office.
Had some bad stories. I'll go on the other side on this one, though. There's just some good news on the subject, though being limited. Is I did some work a few years ago actually looking at supermarket advantage programs and non-clipping coupons, Star Markets programs specifically. And the promise at the time was just incredible. They were going to do all these wonderful things with these cards. They were going to be able to track you. They're going to be able to know the last time you bought toothpaste. They're going to be able to give you a coupon at the exact right moment when you're going to run out of shampoo and toothpaste. They had wonderful ideas about everything that was going to happen. And pretty much none of it has really developed. It's been pretty much a disaster. It's ended up being pretty much a card. They saved the money on printing coupons. That's about all they've done so far with the whole program.
Do you think they keep the data just in case?
I think they do, but I mean, I guess the insight is, though, a lot of these players who've done it, it's very easy to collect data. It's very hard to process it. Eventually, that's not saying that eventually a lot of this stuff is not going to happen. But the good news is that differential types of data collection, different variables that are corrected, different formats, timing, they make it very, very hard to build up really good databases. And for the moment, there's a lot of information floating around, but really linking it into a usable profile yet is very, very hard.
Yeah, we noticed that in readings, one of which was some advice if you are running a supermarket or whatever, looking to gather lots of data. I mean, part of the message of the reading of that one particular article was, hey, it's not that hard. And then you see the raft of different software applications you're supposed to use, and data formats, and surely it is an ambitious thing. On the other hand, you can keep the data lying around until you figure out how to do it, and then maybe make something out of it. I agree, though, that you know, people who run supermarket chains aren't necessarily, in along this dimension, the brightest bulbs in the drawer, as somebody else recently put it. But suppose we got somebody who was a real expert at knowing a customer into, say, Amazon.com. Jeff Bezos is ousted by an angry board after his stock cuts itself in half yet again. And Michael Levine is called in to rescue the company and to figure out how to make some profit out of this stuff. So along the dimensions of the sort of price discrimination we're talking about, knowing your customer so well that you're in a position to do pretty good first degree, perhaps, price discrimination, knowing how big the wallet is, and certainly really refined proxies for reservation price that maybe the airlines could never even dream of doing. What are the sorts of data you want to collect, and how would you use it?
If you really want to get one of the nightmare scenarios, I mean, you would like people's you would want to know, and you do on the web typically know, you know, for a customer their zip code, which gives you geographic areas. You'd really like to know what census tract you're in. That's a lot harder to ask because most people don't know. As you like more granular data.
You get their 9 digits in here.
Pardon?
If you get their 9 digits in
here. Right. You do better if you get their 9 digits in. You would love to have the tax returns available, but I guess that's a little more difficult to do. You'd like to track their behavior. One of the reasons why things like DoubleClick and so on are so useful are these people who have gone to the end of a buying process and then bailed out. Typically, I was saying I opened 2 windows. You wouldn't necessarily know if you were at it. You would like to know at Amazon.com that for some reason I keep dropping out 2/3 of the way through the process. It would be really useful to know where I went with my computer after I dropped out. Did I go off to something to Land's End? That is to qualify something else. Or did I go straight back to be ESPN.com and buy the book. That would tell you a lot about the slope of your demand curve. Whether ESPN.com would want to give you that information, I don't know, but as is in these materials, there are game theory situations in which both BN and Amazon would find it more valuable to exchange the data than not to exchange the data. And one way to exchange it is through a surrogate buying the data from a third party.
Now, if you're in a market for which Nathan Seen, say, you can look at the books, you don't have a monopoly. You're selling books, say, just like everybody else. Your Amazon BN stuff is selling the same books, and they're totally substitutable. And let's further suppose that we'll get rid of the truly good customers, which is to say the real lazy sacks who just go to Amazon because that's where they buy a book, click the buy, and, you know, you just frisk them on the way out, and they truly have
no money. See, but if you're BN.com, you'd like to know about those customers. You would pay a fortune to have one of those customers. Because
once you have them, they're not going to leave.
They're very sticky customers. So you'd love to know that someone was doing that at Amazon. You might send them the offer and all offers.
And we also get into this kinds of battles we see when MCI and AT&T battle over your $2.50 long distance bill each month as to who will do it. And the regulatory structure about slamming those from
the market. Well, even more, it turns out that internet, ISP, turns out to be a lot stickier than anyone imagined in the first place because people have identified their email addresses. And once you've promulgated your email address, it's really expensive time and effort to promulgate a new email address. And so it turns out customers will stay with an ISP for a lot longer than they might otherwise have stayed. And so it's worthwhile doing very aggressive introductory offers if you're an ISP, because once you get some, use some of that mailbox, you are likely to keep them for a while. So in the same way, if I were at Amazon, I would love to know who BN.com's sticky customers are.
But for those customers who are using the kind of friction-free, just-click-here-and-there method of shopping, comparatively, there are only two windows. Is there price discrimination likely then to take place? Maybe you know that they're quite wealthy, they can afford the book, and if there were significant convenience, they're going to pay a higher price.
It's a lot harder. I mean, there are institutionalized forms of fraud. For example, you mentioned My Simon. You know, not everyone part. My Simon does not search every website. I serve Simon only searches websites who have paid to be searched by My Simon. In principle, My Simon, which appears to offer objective information about where the lowest prices are, does not. There are some shopping bots that do. Price Scan is better for those of you who are interested in this sort of thing. And so there are ways that you can try to get higher income, try to extract income from higher level consumers by limiting their searches in ways that they don't observe.
So what kind of empirical prediction can we make about, say, Amazon.com, given that they're not typically a monopoly position for that we can sell? What prediction could we make, assuming they had a mother load of data about their individual consumers, as to how tempted they would be to quote different prices on the basis of what they know, given that the end is just a click away?
If I were running Amazon, I wish that would be. If I were running Amazon, I would run some experiments. And I would try to, I don't know the answer. Because what you need to do is to have a sort of loss to gain ratio. That is, I need to run some experiments on some blocks of consumers and carefully monitor what I thought I knew about them. Then experiment with running prices, different prices with different blocks of consumers, and see how many of them I manage to get extra money from compared to how many I lose. And that in turn would also be influenced by how sticky I thought the customers were. If I thought they'd be attracted back to me, I can afford to lose them on an experiment. And I say, oh, that we don't do that anymore. If I thought they were relatively sticky, losing them is going to be very expensive because the impact will be hard.
Right.
And that's a customer I'd like not to run that experiment.
Right. So far, we're looking at one end of the spectrum, which is just how they price a variable, which is a function of what you know about the consumer. Some of the things that may have caused those creeps were along other dimensions, which maybe is fungible with money, but banks deciding whether or not to have you a break on amount of check fee, or how much customer service to give you in the
hardware store, I imagine it could be quite useful.
Actually, I don't find any of that creepy. I find creepy just the assemblage, the fact that you can get a lot of information in one place about people that goes to stuff well beyond how you treat them as customers. I think the notion that stores treat good, profitable customers better than unprofitable customers, I find it amazing, for this is now, this is my life in business, right, being reflected in my account. I find it astonishing that anyone can complain about that. They themselves, if they were running a store, would treat customers differentially in the sense that it's very costly to treat everyone the same, and that means if you're doing that, you can't treat good customers well enough to hold them.
So let's take a case, and you can tell me how hypothetical it is, trying to represent maybe an extreme example. Suppose there are certain airline passengers that are just complete nuisances. They're always somehow having their baggage lost, they're constantly demanding refunds, they send back some food when it comes, a flight attendant always has to negotiate with them when they come on the plane. Could they be declared simply persona non grata? And I'm sorry, the Northwest just doesn't want to fly.
Most airlines have special lists, but it's not commercial. Slugging the flight attendant will get you on a list like that.
And for that, no more Northwest Reaver, ever.
Oh, well, ever, who knows, but not for a long time.
But if you could be more refined about the troubled passengers, you don't slug them, but you're on your way. You could imagine quoting them higher prices for tickets or simply telling them no seat available today.
Well, you do the reverse. You make seats available for very good customers. Well, any of you who have had jobs in which you've traveled a lot will know that if you're in one of the better frequent flyer programs, seats will miraculously open up for you on flights where they're not available for anyone else, and where the company may not even make the most money from selling that seat to you today, but it hopes to make the most money from you by keeping you as a loyal customer. Because every time you fly American, United, Northwest, fill in the blank, you seem to get what you need, and you know that concentrating your business will get you that.
So if there's no baseline grounded in reality as to how many actual physical seats are in the plane, then isn't it functionally equivalent to fine seats for good people, which in turn is really denying seats to them?
Well, that's right. There is a function. There is a physical limit, but you can even make a seat where one didn't exist by buying someone off. You've all seen the volunteer process at airports. I've had Northwest, for example, when I was there, I don't know what the policy is now, there were certain customers, we had a policy of always making reservations. That was just in their view for a while. A flight could not be sold out for them. All that meant is that if the flight was over, but first of all, you might have time between now and the time the flight leaves to work your inventory down to the seat size of the flight. As customers cancel, you have to take seats out of inventory. But even if you did, you would operate the flight overbooked. You'd come to the airport, you'd see that sign that says, you know, if you're willing to take a later flight, we'll pay you. And you could almost always buy somebody off the flight. So that was just a cost of creating that seat.
Gotcha.
Do you think that companies should treat similarly situated individuals the same? I'll give you an example. My aunt has been flying Delta for the past 20 years. She lives in Atlanta. She only flies Delta. She's a secretary. She's CEO of a big Atlanta firm, only books Delta. We went to Orlando together, and her baggage was lost. The woman in front of us complained. There were two people whose baggage was lost. They both went to Puerto Rico, actually. But the woman in front of us complained. They, you know, sort of apologized, ushered her along, that was it. My aunt went up to the window, complained. She got 3,000 bonus miles, $200 to buy added, you know,
clothes.
But don't you think that's, I mean, I have to admit, I thought that was wrong. I felt it was wrong because they were both out of luggage. I think they both deserve some sort of equal sort of apology. And I saw it as one woman not getting the same as someone else got.
I find that fascinating. It's a commercial relationship. It's not a civil right. Now, because she was an African American, or if we had a policy that we, you know, were nasty to tall people but nice to short people, I would have a very different view. But if she's a more commercially significant person, it's not surprising.
Would it matter if there were patterns? Would it matter if there were patterns and who was commercially significant and who was not?
No, look, I, that. First of all, people make choices about where they want to concentrate their business. So that's, some people will be very good customers in some places and not in others. So, and it, I also believe that life is unfair to a degree, and there are limits to what the law should do to make it fair for people. That doesn't mean that there aren't limits to how unfair it should be, and there are, and there are some things that you should intervene with. But I don't think you can, I don't think you should attempt to make the commercial experience an equally satisfying experience for every customer, whether or not the customer is profitable or unprofitable. That's a personal view.
And you see, your name tag says Susan Lee. Is that part of it? In fact, you say Susan Lee too. You say Susan Lee, Susan L. There's some flow plan going on here. No doubt there's a message within this. Susan, perhaps you can tell us.
Susan Lee, the scientist, I expand on what Professor Jacob was just asking about what are their trends. So, what if you don't discriminate your customers based on whether or not they're black? But you find that most of the customers who are African American also happen to be customers who fly less. And so, what you find is that in reality, on the ground, most of those customers aren't getting 3,000 miles and $200, and they all, primarily happen to be black.
So
the intent isn't discriminatory, the impact is.
I guess my view is those people aren't as good airline customers, and as long as black people who fly a lot get treated just like white people who fly a lot, that's fine. And it may well be that at the store that sells things that black people buy more than white people, that not because they're black, but more black customers get treated well than white customers. And as there is in this country, for example, now, thank goodness, an expanding black middle class, they do have different consumption patterns than white middle class people, and I bet they get treated a lot better at the places they buy a lot of things.
What if we added to that, though, zip codes that were associated with black people, and
that's
the information that's available as well.
Are you asking me to justify redlining? I'm not going to justify redlining. If you're going to ask me to try to make up for 300 years of really terrible experience for black people in America by basically treating them all better as customers than they would otherwise be treated, I'm not sure I understand the connection. Others might. Probably I'll make it a public email.
Probably from Sue Lee.
Yeah.
Then perhaps one of the freedoms that this information can grant you is, there's no information, it's a fact that some source argues just such things, discriminating against people based on race or age or things like that. Perhaps this information actually, for those who don't have patterns that fit these stereotypes, is actually something that tries to treat better.
Well, it would also make it easier to make a total legal case. That is, discovery is a lot more rewarding in a world in which this much information is available.
Whether that's more or less creepy or scale.
Well, it may be creepy, but in fact, in terms of what you were just describing, if I were a black person who was being treated badly despite the fact that I was an affluent black person, I would have the data to demonstrate that I had been, and if I were running a class, if I were a class action lawyer, that would be very valuable to them.
Yeah, the part that I actually find creepy is I actually agree that in a lot of these commercial situations, this sort of discrimination is fine. But what about in the case of insurance? I guess, especially, for instance, if you're talking about health insurance, health insurers would like to have perfect information about, essentially about your current state of health and, all the different vital signs that you have. And to the extent to which they could discriminate sort of perfectly categorize you as a good or bad risk and discriminate perfectly. But it seems to me that this sort of goes against the very idea of, insurance in general.
Well, there is a real paradox, there's no question. And to the extent that you eliminate uncertainty, all an insurance company quotes you a perfect rate, all they're doing is taking your money to give it back. The only way insurance has value is if you aggregate uncertainty. If uncertainty is taken away, insurance has no value. Because no one is going to be in the business of in effect taking $100 from you and giving you $200 in expected value.
I would suggest that insurance has two purposes, one of which is to smooth over uncertainty, to pay a fixed price so that if the bad event materializes, you don't owe the high one. But a second reason just may be to have those who do get hit by high prices get subsidized by those who just don't have to bear
it. Yeah, well, that's a separate.
That's one for which if the uncertainty goes away, you can no longer do
it. Well, even for the first one, if the uncertainty goes away, if the uncertainty truly goes away, I not only know that I'm going to die, but I know, which is a certainty after all, but I know when
I make this into your mindset, if I should die.
When? Right. But I know, let's assume I knew when I was going to die, and my insurance company knew when I was going to die. What kind of smoothing did they offer? What kind of risk smoothing did they offer? Did they know when I'm going to go, and I know when I'm going to go? The only question is whether they hold the money to get back to me or I hold the money.
Or which you can never see as a public policy matter, the idea that just like with the kids, ignorance gives you bliss.
Oh, yeah, there are all sorts of nuances in this, and including the fact that insurance may be used as a social vehicle. That's a separate question. And in terms of pure insurance, insurance goes away when uncertainty goes away.
So, John, maybe you can jump to a website real quick. Go to www.crq.com. Many people know where we're about to go. That's right, it's QCAT. And as you can see, it looks like a mouse, but in fact, it's a cat. And it's a weird kind of cat-like plastic object with an LED at the front. In fact, if you read the fact on the cat, one of the questions is, will I be blinded if I look like a cat in the eye? You'll be gratified to hear the answer is no. Now, what is the QCAT? It turns out that the QCAT is a barcode reader, and you can get it for free. It costs you absolutely nothing. Radio Shack has a deal with them, so does Wired Magazine and a couple of other measures. And you get the QCAT reader, and it installs a bunch of software on your machine. And then as you're reading stuff, say Radio Shack catalog or Wired Magazine, instead of the old-fashioned Circle 52 on your reader service card, you instead scan the URL, I'm sorry, not URL, UPC code, and it translates to a URL that then is somehow relevant to the UPC code that you grab. And of course, the QCAT people gather all sorts of data about what barcodes you're scanning. And in turn, they can, unlock domain names, collect some surplus for agreeing to hook up a given UPC code to a given web page, just like a domain name hooks a given word to a given web page. So that's QCAT. It has taken a look at hundreds of thousands of these cats are going out. Does anybody here have a QCAT? Uh-huh. Have I described it fairly?
Yeah, it's actually me. I have a problem with it. It's very useful. I just want to play with the first thing. You just take a code key and scan the sign up and interact with wall.com or anything like that. And I think the potential for print media, particularly, is, especially with the, you know, the limited domain name space, the potential for print media is really good because they can do a car ad and have one of these bottom apps. One of the other things they're often not doing is installing these ads and the potential to have a marker at the bottom. You say, the web page for the car.
You take a lot of magazines right by your computer.
What's that?
Do you read a lot of magazines?
No, but I rip out to the corner, or it could be a car.
Well, just like course, the next version is the
corner. Yeah, I love reviewing the magazines. I mean, we do things like this. And then also, they add, there's a second part to it that goes up to your TV.
Yes, it's called a convergence cable.
Yeah,
it's a little description of the convergence cable.
And that's a little further away, I think.
They'll throw on a free convergence cable. Convergence cable is a system component that links your computer to your television, allowing special broadcast cues to automatically direct your browser directly to where you need to go. Connecting the audio out of your TV, the cable carries the cues to your computer via the audio in. And the CRQ software that interprets these special codes and serves relevant, helpful content automatically. And of course, if you imagine someday web TV not being an entire disaster, you need not even hook a cable from your TV to your computer or browser 3 rooms over, but it's basically the same appliance that is driving the internet-based stuff to the TV-based stuff, which in turn is knowing what you're watching, when you're watching, and be able to track what you want. I don't mean to say this necessarily to shake the rafters and say this is terrifying, but I just want to lay out a little bit the future that's sort of around the corner, and it may well begin with the QCAT. It also means you can bring your cat the portable model just to, you know, Home Depot and scan the URLs and things, and then either through, they're trying to run it to StarTAC homes. And there's a wonderful transcript of an interview on CNN about the QCAT going into the telephone, for which the interviewer says, wow, this raises all sorts of issues. What's going to happen with battery life? And it turns out the phone didn't have battery life very bad, and the interview was quite satisfying. So, as somebody not readily creeped out, in fact, affirmatively happy about many forms of crisis information, at least along the lines we described, does it seem any creepier to you? I'm just not working here. Does it seem any creepier to you, the idea that 3-4 years from now, people wander into Home Depot, they're all carrying by the neck these little cats, and they're scanning stuff as they walk down the aisles, and not only are they then learning about the products, but the products in turn are learning about them, because obviously their cat's going to have a serial number that says, this is what this cat holder was willing to pay.
Well, if I were running a system like that, and if I were competing, what I would try to do is I would try to offer a system that can be scanned at the Home Depot, also searching the prices of those. I mean, there are a lot of ways that this can cut both ways.
In fact, if they offer you a discount at that moment, it says, they say $5.
Don't buy it. Just as you go like that, a signal shows up on your StarTAC that says, don't buy that here at Home Depot. I mean, just go down the street to Lowe's and we'll sell it to you for 20% less.
So you think the system will ultimately mean lower prices for people?
Right.
It's going to be price predictions where some get lower, some get higher?
Yes, just as we were suggesting earlier, that, I mean, price predictions are very, the reason I'm not quote creeped out by it, it's a very mixed bag, it has a lot of benefits. And obviously, to the extent that you are a person who has, to the extent that you are a person who always ends up paying higher prices, you won't like it much, but you're probably, you won't be as aware of the degree to which you have more choice as a result of the availability of products whose common costs are being allocated unequally.
And presumably somebody who doesn't want to participate in the scheme or part of data, unlike, for instance, the Pizza Hut example we saw, where there's no pizza for you unless you tell us where you live, even though you're just getting paid out, it would typically be, you know, yeah, you just pay the shelf price, but if you happen to have that QCAT with you, we can see if we can work out something a little better for you. In which case, you just have inflation of retail and then discounts.
But folks who are worse off under price discrimination are folks who would have been happy with what they could have gotten under a single price system, and who are in the upper tail of the demand distribution and are paying more than they would have paid had the system been blinder.
Which is to say, either people who are wealthier, they've got more to pay, so the marginal value of that dollar they lose is less to them than to a fellow customer, or who just desperately need the stuff. This is infant formula. We know you've got food at home. You haven't been to the market in a week. You are out of infant stuff. And I'm sorry, $12, please. Thank you. Come again. So I want to give our panel a chance if you guys have not been active, but anything else you want to introduce, and I'll throw it over to go ahead.
Isn't this whole thing about price discrimination similar to how the internet is run like right now? Because obviously it creates a lot of people, myself included, who gather this much information on me, and I especially like the idea of them being able to link it with my name or other personally identifying people information. But again, if you have advertisements on the net, and the advertisements are what's supporting a lot of the internet being free to everybody, if for some reason the advertisements are no longer effective, meaning you only have money to buy 10 ads and you know where to target them, what would the model of the internet look like? Would that be something that you'd have to charge? And that would also lead to questions, I would think, only the wealthy would have to be able to use the internet because we'd have to be a service you have to pay for.
I think there are very people like subscription television without commercials that is willing to pay for subscription television without commercials. Poor people are willing to take commercials so they can have a wide variety of material free. And you could argue that poor people are better off if richer people aren't offered subscription television. Because the richer people will, some won't watch, but some will watch, and be very valuable to advertise to, and the poor people get to be back with them.
And in fact, I think in one of our earlier sessions, we talked about Massachusetts schools and the offer there of free to have a 116 size constant ad in that culture for young candy, and they can track, you know, when the kids are finally so enticed by the dancing M&M that they click. And then the rest of the screen, right, 15-16ths of the screen, pure education. And that's a deal for which I was describing it to the governor of Pennsylvania in odd circumstance. And he lit up with excitement. He's, you know, give me a name of the company, we could really use them here in Harrisburg. And I don't know if that's pretty new or if it's not. It might well be that a lot of people get computers that otherwise wouldn't get computers. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, if you live on the main line, you might not want your kids exposed to the 116. You might be willing to pay in your taxes to have the school have a television anyway. On the other hand, if you live in North Philadelphia, I would like to offer the deal.
In fact, just like I guess you give your kids lunch money so they avoid whatever the free lunch program is, you give them that money and they put it in the right card and yeah, stand sure that they scan straight down.
I'm still trying to put the finger on what's supremely about price discrimination. Do you think at least that firms should be obliged to reveal to the customers the way that they categorize them?
You know, it's a secret, isn't it?
The way you configurize, the way we configure what exactly, I want to be very specific about what you want us to reveal.
For example, I remember it was a case where I think there's some norm that said that customers should be aware of advertising that they see. For example, once ads on TV that flickered for a microsecond, and that was if they're illegal.
Well, I don't like subliminal advertising either, but I'm missing where you want to go. What information?
Like
I think some information you should have to reveal and some not. And I'm trying to figure out which one. What you're getting.
Like, where do they collect their information from?
Oh, I believe that you ought to have the same access to your double quick file that you have under the Fair Credit Reporting Act to your Fair Credit Report. You ought to be able to correct information in there and all the rest of it, know what they know about me. I don't have any problem with that. I have more problem with your having access to the algorithms that people process the data to decide what price to offer you. That's like asking for giving a seller in a shop of Pentathol and insisting that they tell you the lowest price ever you would actually
afford. But this is what you're asking the client. When you're collecting this information from the customer, you're injecting him some credit, makes him tell you what price you will pay, and you're asking him the same, that you won't give the same information. About yourself.
Well, have you ever attempted to strip cookies out of your browser?
Yeah.
It makes surfing an extremely unpleasant experience, doesn't it?
Maybe I'm willing to pay some.
That's fine, the strip cookies out of your browser, and they won't know a lot about it.
Yeah, well, but it's impossible.
We're starting down with the 5-minute warning according to our atomic clock, just in time. We let Tony and Marianne in, and I'll try to pull together and tell you. Maybe you need to turn off your source of order. There you go. Hey, the final piece of the next slide.
This question sort of hits on our students and needs. You answered a bit. So imagine that people have mistakenly all been set Susan Lee's profile, or Susan Lee has set somebody else's Susan Lee's profile. So you say that there should be some mechanism by which you can go in and correct the profiles, but is there any market incentive?
There is such a thing as slander of credit and so on. There are mechanisms already in the common law that such that the I can't remember the word of art, but it's basically propagating false information is maybe liable. Now there are circumstances in which you are and aren't liable, and you might want to keep the liable.
But you have to know first that somebody has mistakenly. There's no way of going in
and
there's the credit report and just checking out your file.
Well, I'm saying that I don't find it unacceptable that people should be allowed to find out what the world knows about.
And how would you correct it?
We are so far beyond my level of expertise that I don't know what to say. I'm just saying I don't object in principle to that. Whether it's how you do it as a practical matter, I don't know.
So let's work that into our wrap-up, which is handy.
type of information that they're using about you, collecting about you, and what they're doing with it. The whole point is that most of the time they're not trying to get rid of bad customers, though I guess sometimes they are. But most of the time they're trying to make you a better customer. So if you know that if you fly a lot of miles, you're going to get better treatment, there's an incentive for you to do that. So I think lots of times there is actually more of an incentive to disclose that information.
Yeah. Just one quick thing. From what I understand, the double click privacy statement, you can go in and look your profile and play around with it. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I wish we had quickly our vendors was here to go in and look at the double click profile for the INS ThinkPad 570. It's not all that illuminating. Just as if you were to look at the digital silhouette generated by predictive networks, it's a bunch of numbers. It's a look at cookies, they're a bunch of numbers. You really have to do some work to figure out what concepts it has to.
And the other quick comment that I had is instead of having the market sort of regulated, I think the real fear of fear is with the government to regulate it. The law firm has that this summer. They were actually prepping the president of, I can't remember what privacy organization, to go testify before some congressional committee because they were getting annoyed at what the whole thing was doing and were ready to kind of stomp in with the iron fist and lay down the law, and they wanted them to back off a bit and say, no, look, there are people who can do it well as well, so let's see how the privacy organizations can play it out for themselves. So I think the real fear is for the government just to step in and make some rules that people are going to have to follow.
Aren't you afraid also the government will get the information? I'd rather have double click the information on the other option.
So, as we try to then inventory,
one more thing. We did our experiment at the beginning of class, seeing how many people would accept cookies for giving us information. And what we found out is that 14% of 2Ls in the class wear sneakers, 19% of 3Ls in the class wear sneakers, and 29% of the other people wear sneakers. So we're going to sell that data to whoever will pay for it now.
Oh, God bless. I still feel like I got better of you by having a cookie, but that's a start of things.
That's what you think.
Yeah. Thank you for your creative experiment. And you offered milk as well. So that was a clue. So as we try to figure out, I think it's a totally reasonable question, what gives us the green seal? I know it's an encoded question, but it's one from which, as we've seen, law as yet does not have very structured patterns of thinking about this. And, of course, in the absence of structured patterns, anything can go if the law more formally says otherwise. I think it's a totally reasonable question to figure out. You know, we just sort of nervous for no reason. You know, we're just sort of scared of things that were and click. Or is it something really under it? Some of the things we've heard so far have been, they're going to gather a lot of data on me that will be inaccurate. And as a result, I'll see ads for things I don't like. I'll be quoted prices that by all rights I shouldn't be quoted. Maybe they'll be higher, maybe they'll be lower, but somehow it just won't fit. And there may be things that I do for which I ought to at some point be forgiven by the person with whom I'm transacting, particularly if I never did it to them. That's not how Ben felt, who's here quickly, like it's gone. When Mercado said, we will not deal with you because we know just the kind of person you are. I don't know how often we'll see refusals to deal or extraordinary price swings depending on what information you present about yourself as we go. I think it's still speculative to conclude what the market will do. At least as part of nightmare number one, if you have bad data on you, I at least figure, well, there are some market reasons for them to have good data on you. They're not particularly happy if they're misquoting you a price on the basis of data. It's true that you have important data from a neural net, who knows what's going to spit out. But you know, we hope that it's more accurate over the long run than anything else. The real question then may be, presume that everything is wonderfully accurate. Would we have the right rights to go in and check things out and, you know, beat our case if we didn't get it wrong? Is there anything so bad about total knowledge about your habits in the commercial context? We can figure out the answer to that question. We might have a lead on whether we think there's some legal and policy response called for. I would say, as a procedural matter, it is called for. Better to do it now before you have the institutions set up and then, as a public choice matter, vested interests are going to fight legitimately against their businesses being shut down or constrained, rather than later when they're already there. So this is something we're thinking about. Rounding out that nightmare might make a good paper topic. I know there's a lot of reading this week as we round out the readings of the design in the course. A new batch of readings, significantly easier on the readings, will be available shortly. I'll email you all when that's the case. And as we round into flyout week, there will be no rotisserie question between now and the end of flyout week, which gives you two glorious weeks of intellectual atrophy, which I hope you will put to good use. Please join me in thanking Professor Levine. We'll see you all tomorrow to talk about another kind of filter discrimination, that on the content.
Can you just touch your lighting up here?